The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Okay. Good evening, and welcome to tonight's Free Library of Philadelphia author event. I'm Phil Cashton. I'm a librarian here at the Free Library. Our speaker tonight is Jacqueline Edelberg, author of How to Walk to School. How to Walk to School chronicles how one community transformed Nettlehorst Elementary from a struggling school into a good one. Our speaker, Jacqueline Edelberg, and her fellow parents were able to accomplish this, working in collaboration with the school principal and their community. The idea that the parents could fix the school seemed like an impossible dream, but they succeeded despite the odds that were against them. Ms. Edelberg's story serves as inspiration for rejuvenating America's troubled schools. Now I present to you our speaker, Jacqueline Edelberg.
Thank you. So hello, thank you for coming out on what must be probably the most beautiful day in Philadelphia to be inside when you all should be outside eating dinner. So that is really nice. So hopefully after this, everyone will go outside and have dinner. First, thank you very much to Lee Fishman and Michael Fox and Cheryl and Alan Barr who are here. And later on, Arlene Ackerman is coming, which is kind of cool. And Marjorie Margolis was really helpful in setting this up too. So I thought what I would do is tell our story, and then I'm going to show you a short video about the school, which will illuminate some things. And then I thought we could have a rather forthright question and answer period. Is my mic working here? Can I just walk around like a normal person? Okay, I'm going to set this here. So my 6 years ago, my husband was supposed to do all of the research on schools. And then he told me he was too busy at work and that I was going to have to do that. And I was like, oh, my God, you cannot drop this in my lap. This is a huge, huge, huge project. If you live in Chicago, and now I understand if you live in Philadelphia, too, this is the same crazy, overwhelming, ridiculous project to try to figure out how on earth you're going to make public school work for your kids. The problem in Chicago, as I understand it, is the same now as what I'm understanding in Philadelphia, too, which is trying to get your kid into an established magnet school that's reputable. In Chicago, it's statistically easier to get your high school senior into Harvard than it is to get your kindergartner into an established magnet school. And then trying to get your kid into a private school is just as daunting. And then let's pretend you could get your kid into a private school. You know, good luck being able to eat out again or go on vacation or, afford Ford College, say, later on. So it's no wonder why in Chicago, as in Philadelphia, people decide when their kids hit five that they've really had it with the city as much as they love it and are going to move off to the suburbs. For me, the thought of moving to the suburbs, you know, and spending the rest of my life at an Olive Garden, you know, I'd rather eat glass, like just ugh, awful. So my girlfriend in the park and I decided we should check out Nettlehorst, which was our neighborhood school, to see just how terrible this place was before we panicked or went down that magnet school or private school lottery path or even moved out to the suburbs. And so we made an appointment. We met with the principal. And the principal at the time, Susan Kurland, who I co-wrote the book with, showed us around for 3 hours. And she said, what do I have to do to get your kids to come to school here? Because at that point, nobody in the neighborhood went to school there. Of the 300 kids who lived in my area, I think here in Philadelphia you guys call it catchment, we call it attendance boundary in Chicago. Of the 300 kids who lived in my attendance boundary who chose a Chicago public school, six of them chose Nettlehorst. Everyone else chose another school. The perception was the school was that bad. It was in the neighborhood milieu, it was overrun by drugs and gangs and violence. And you know, it was just not a suitable place where you would send your kid if you had other options. And in fact, people who had other options opted not to go there. So she said, what do I have to do to get your kids to come to school here? And we said, well, that is a very interesting question. We'll come back tomorrow. We'll let you know. So we went home, and we parked our kids in front of Dora the Explorer, and we cracked open a bottle of wine. And we really thought about it. Like, what would it take to make an entire neighborhood walk in en masse? And we came back the next day, as promised, with this 5-page typewritten list of all the things that we thought would have to be in place in order to make a neighborhood walk in. And Susan read our list, and she said, well, let's get going, girls. It's going to be a very busy year. We said, well, that's very interesting. So what do? We went to our little neighborhood park, which is, gosh, maybe half the size of this auditorium. And we started to organize. And you'd say to mommies, what did you do before you were a nothing? And they'd say, oh, I was the ad exec for Gatorade. I was a partner at Skadden and Arp. You know, I'm an artist. I'm a this. I'm a that. It went on and on and on and on and on. And we thought, well, instead of talking about what's on sale at the Gap and all, you know, as intriguing as that is, so long as we're all sitting around this sandbox for the next 6 hours, maybe we could put our heads together and figure out how to fix this place so that we could all just stay in this neighborhood that we love, doing just about what we were doing that day and the same day every other day. So we put all of these mommies onto teams. And we had infrastructure and PR and curriculum and marketing and enrichment. And all of those teams had to succeed concurrently in order to make the project work. You couldn't fix the library 1 year and then say, well, we're going to deal with the enrichment piece 2 years from now. And we're going to deal with, you know, that decrepit gym 3 years from now. We knew that in order to attract the neighborhood, all of those teams had to succeed concurrently. And by our lights, we figured we had 9 months to pull it off. We figured we had 9 months because we walked in June. And then backing out of it, if everybody got their acceptance letters in spring, and when they all got rejected from private schools and magnet schools, as everybody would, Nettlehurst had to be in their sloppy panic file. The thought, like, oh, no, this is our disaster file. This isn't even really an option, but at least they had to have the information. And we knew that if we weren't an option on the table at that moment, all of the energy in the park would dissipate, and everybody would go off on their separate ways and make, you know, do what they needed to do for their family, and then that energy of the park would be lost. So let me give you a snapshot of what Nettlehurst looked like when Susan Kurland inherited it. When we walked in the door, the principal had been there for 2 years. She was a new principal. She'd been there for 2 years. When she inherited it, 10 years before she got there, for an entire decade, there had been 7 different administrators in 10 years. And before she got there, the board had assigned 2 principals to get the school under control. The test scores were in the high 20s. It was entirely minority. It was 98% free and reduced lunch. There was a 50% mobility rate. And Nettlehurst at that point was a receiving school, which meant that because the neighborhood refused to come, the board, in their infinite wisdom, decided to bus kids in from overcrowded schools, not to satisfy any racial mandate. It's just that the neighborhood refused to go, so the board filled the positions with kids from somewhere. But what that meant is that every day, 14 buses pulled up with kids from 7 different locations, dropped out kids who had very little interest in attending that school, because as you can imagine, schools do not bus out their very highest performing students. Their parents had very little interest in them being there either. And every year, there was almost an entirely new crop of these kids every single year. So when Susan took it on, she really, really worked very hard to fix this place. She brought order into schools. She rode the buses herself. She really brought order into the school. Teachers were suddenly now in their classrooms. They were doing their job. So when we walked in, the school had already decided to stop busing because the school had stabilized, the scores were starting to rise. The school was really, you know, kind of on the up and up. But the school couldn't figure out how to attract the neighborhood. They kept saying, why isn't anybody coming? Clearly, we've made these enormous strides. Test scores are now in the 30s. We've got the stable population. Things are okay. How come the neighborhood won't come? And the reason why the neighborhood wouldn't come is because it's really, really complicated. You can't just put a shingle outside and say, Nettlehurst, you know, not so crappy. Look again, right? It's complicated. The neighborhoods don't work that way. So when we walked in, I think by most people's standards, people would have said Nettlehurst was a perfectly fine Chicago public school. There were schools that are on academic probation. There were schools that were really, that are real problems in Chicago. Nettlehurst really wasn't one of them. But yet, it wasn't at the caliber of where it needed to be that people who lived in the neighborhood who had other options would have chosen it. So Nettlehurst suffered from some real problems and some perceptual problems. Now, real problems are actually really, really easy to fix. There are ways to finagle books and supplies. Paint goes a really, really long way. The perceptual problems took, I would say, 70% of our efforts. It is really complicated how you change neighborhood perceptions that have been built up for 20 years. So I thought what I would do is give you a little overview of what each team did, starting with the infrastructure team. The first thing we did is we took the principal on a walk around the school, and we had her look at the school in the way an outsider would see it. And Nettlehurst is a 120-year-old red brick building. It looks an awful lot like every little elementary school here in Philadelphia, charming, adorable, gorgeous building. But to an outsider, it really kind of looked like a penitentiary. You know, all the signs said, get lost, no ball playing, all the doors were brown and locked, most of the window shades were drawn. It really kind of looked like a halfway house. So we worked really hard to make this school vibrant and amazing. In the first 2 years, we had over $500,000 of donated goods and services, and it was all poured into love and affection into the place. And we've had every artist in the city, and there isn't an inch of the school that hasn't been licked by a neighborhood artist. And I promise you, it really is delicious magic on a plate. And at the end, I'll show you a video because I could talk forever in a day, and it won't do justice to what a little bit of paint and moxie has been able to pull off. The enrichment team had a real pickle. How do you bring energy and resources into a school that is an isolated island unto itself? So the first thing we did is we went around and we figured out who were the stakeholders in our neighborhood. And we started partnerships with the Chamber of Commerce and all of the neighborhood groups. And anybody who was anybody, we talked to and made partnerships. So now, let's say, with the Chamber of Commerce, the Halloween hoopla is at the school in the front play lot. All of the things that they did, we said, look, we've got this place. It's all yours. It belongs to you. And we want you to have it at the school. So we have Halloween hooplas and Easter egg hunts and pet days and all that sort of stuff, and that's all at the school. The other thing we did is we started a farmer's market. We started a farmer's market with Bensonon USA. They run 600 markets in Paris, and we were their first Chicago market. School doesn't run it. God knows the school cannot run a farmer's market, but it's contracted out to a third party. We don't make any money on it, but the idea was that people should put going to and Nettlehurst into the same sentence, which hadn't happened in 25 years. So every single week, hundreds, thousands of people show up on the front play lot, and now it became something of a town square. The whole idea was, how do you make a school the heart of a community? So that was really important. The enrichment team of moms had a real pickle. how to bring art and culture and sports and stuff like that into a school when you don't have any resources. And you know for sure, none are ever going to come. So what we did is we went around to all the people who are the best in the city at what they did. These names won't mean anything to you, but in Chicago, like Ballet d'Enfant and Lille Street and HMD Taekwondo, people where if somebody said to you, you're going to take your kid and send them to a piano lesson, where would you go? Well, if everybody is going to this place, go talk to them. So we talked to these people. We said, look, you can partner with us, charge your normal rates, stay here rent-free, electricity-free, marketing-free. And all we asked in exchange were two things. The first thing is that everybody had to offer scholarships, which they did anyhow because they're decent do-gooding people. But then they also had to contribute to the regular curriculum day, some nominal amount. So here we had minimal art, theater, dance, music. Now we suddenly had more than we ever could have dreamed of. It's at no cost to the taxpayer. It's at minimal cost to CPS. The only thing that's required to run our community school, we became one of Chicago's first community schools, is one $40,000 position. Because a mommy cannot run a community center. It just can't be done. So our not-for-profit partner was Jane Addams Whole House Association, but our after-school provider was the Jewish Community Center, which was a half a block away. So the JCC runs a kid club. Kids can be there from 3 to 6, hanging out, doing their homework, whatever. They can still participate in all of the amazing Jane's Place activities. But the idea is instead of throwing 600 children out into the universe every day after school, for heaven's sakes, just invite 30 partners into the school. And what it also means is that there's a way to absorb the goodness from a community. Now, suddenly, it wasn't just Susan's kinky inclination to invite the neighborhood in, right? So let's say you wanted to teach a book club, right? You're a neighbor. You want to come in. You want to teach a book club because that's your expertise. How would it be possible for him to come in and teach a book club since he's, you know, just like a neighbor person? Well, because we have this not-for-profit partner, he can come in once a week. He has their insurance. He has their background check. He has their TB test. He can charge for his time or not. He can set a minimum enrollment. He can do whatever he wants. The only thing we're going to ask is, can you please maybe once a month teach a master book club something with the students? Because what we needed more than cash, and I'm not saying no to cash. Cash would be swell. But we needed expertise more. And this was a way to bring it in a self-sustaining way with experts who are really excited with what they do. Bye. And becoming a community school was probably one of the most singular important things that happened to us. It really made all the difference in the world. And you could do it with the official community school moniker, or you know, you could just do it on your own too. But whoever the stakeholders are in your neighborhood, for heaven's sakes, just, you know, invite everybody in. In terms of academics, I should tell you, I don't know a thing about early childhood education. No background in it. You couldn't pay me enough money to homeschool my kids. But I did know a lot of moms in the park who did know about education. And our curriculum team was filled with psychiatrists, psychologists, former teachers, people who would actually know what they were looking at. The curriculum team went to all of the public and private and parochial schools we would have considered. They sat in on all the classes. They videotaped all of the teachers. And after 4.5 months, they came back basically happy, which was really good news. Because had they come back and said, you know what, guys, this school is fundamentally broken, we likely would have said, I hope your new library works for you, but this is not going to work for us. But the thing they wanted, which is sort of odd, but the thing they wanted more than anything else wasn't reading curriculums or accelerated programs, none of those things. What they wanted more than anything was access. They wanted access to classrooms every single day. And Susan said, fine. We didn't realize at the time that that was something exceptional, even unheard of in public schools or private. But Susan said, sure. And what that meant is, I might not be in my kid's classroom all the time because that might get weird, but you might be in my kid's classroom and I might be in your kid's classroom. And theoretically, with all of us in everybody's classroom, there was this sense that somebody is now minding the store. And that had two really important effects. The first thing is it gave skittish parents, neighborhood parents, the confidence that we were minding the store, that somebody was actually on the ball. And that was really, really important. Now, were we in every classroom every day? No. But could we be? Sure. And what it meant is every time something scurry went on, there was a parent who went, and when I tell you we walked into a really toxic teaching climate, I mean it was really toxic. We had one teacher had a restraining order against her for hitting students in the classroom. I know. We had teachers who muttered obscenities as they walked down the hallway. I mean, it was a little loony. And don't get me wrong, I love great teaching. Love teachers. Love teachers. I really, really, really do not like underperforming teachers. I just don't think there's any space for that when the stakes are so high. So what was very interesting is this kind of access and parental parental presence had a really extraordinary effect. And that was that within the first 2 years of this movement, almost every single underperforming teacher fled ship on their own, almost completely after the first year. It snowballed so fast and so quickly, it surprised us, and it even surprised Susan a great deal. I think what happened is there was a real chilling effect. And people who did not buy into the new Camp Nettlehurst decided that their life would be better somewhere else. And it doesn't take too many disgruntled teachers to really contaminate a staff. There was some exceptional teaching going on at Nettlehurst, and there was some adequate teaching, but it didn't take many really unhappy people to bring everybody way, way down. And as soon as the most disgruntled people left, the teaching staff just like took off. And at this point, there isn't a teacher at Nettlehurst where I would not be happy having my kids in their classroom. I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. And I would put their education on par with any private school in the country. And I see what my friends are doing, and my kids are doing all of the same stuff. So I'm pretty pleased with the academic part of it. One of the reasons, though, I think why also our movement could succeed in terms of the academic component is, we didn't walk in with pistols blaring. We really believed that Susan was a great educator. And we believed that if she wasn't bogged down with everything else, she would be able to do a bang-up job teaching her school. What we said is, Susan, you don't have to be a party planner. You don't have to be a marketing whiz. You don't have to be a community organizer. You don't have to be a decorator. You don't have to be an accountant. You don't have to be any of those things. We'll figure that out. What you do have to do is run a school and run it well. And Susan promised us that if we could do all of this other jazz that we wanted to do, if we could help with that, she promised that if we got on this rickety boat, that her teachers would rise to the occasion. And she promised that, you know, this rickety plane would take us to the other side. And she delivered. She promised her teachers would deliver. They did. She promised the curriculum would deliver. It did. She promised that the caliber of students would rise when the neighborhood came and brought everybody up. It did. All of those things happened. So, but we weren't telling her she was a terrible educator. And I think that went a long way towards us being able to do what we wanted to do. The marketing team had a real pickle. Nettlehurst had 25 years of a bad rap, and that's a lot to overcome. In the 50s, Nettlehurst was one of the best schools in Chicago. You ask anybody who, you know, is 70 years old and still living in the city. Everybody went to Nettlehurst. But it went, the school went into real disrepair in the 70s, as most urban schools did. And the question is how do you change that? How do you change those perceptions? So in the park, the enrichment, the marking team, you know, we had cats from Leo Burnett and all kinds of amazing ad agencies in Chicago. And here's the thing that's crazy. Apparently, you can rebrand and reposition a failing Chicago public school as easy as cereal. Who knew? You know? And it's not like you're selling Ho-Hos or Twinkies or something like that. This is something that everybody needs. They desperately need the school to work. They want it to work. They need it. The question is how do you do it? Chicago Public Schools marketed to the city at large, and their advertising strategy, by the time it got to the people in my neighborhood, they would pick up anything that CPS had put out and sort of say, well, you know, that clinches it. You know, this is really not going to work. So the idea was to push the school into the caliber, even though it was sort of like a big smoke and mirror campaign, onto par with any private school in the city. What we said is, so long as we're making it up, we might as well reinvent, you know, the best school on stilts, and then if we fail, then we'll be, you know, somewhere in the middle. But that's where we're going to start. And in very short order, that lie became reality. And again, much, much more quickly than any of us could have anticipated. We had a really, really edgy advertising campaign. We studied the demographics of mommies in our neighborhood. We targeted the, you know, the real mavens and the people who chatter. I think very few people have a real understanding of how fast information travels throughout the mommy community. It's crazy. Something could happen in a sandbox here, and within days, it will be all the way on the other side of town. Like, everybody, the mommy community really talks, and people don't necessarily understand that, how fast information travels. The last team we had was the fundraising team, which we disbanded within months. It became very clear to us that nobody wants to give money to a failing Chicago public school. And none of the mommies in the park had any interest in being shaken down when we were all investing so much sweat equity into this project. So we decided to abandon that team very, very quickly. So everything we did to fix this school, we did with a budget of nothing. And I'm not saying money doesn't help. Money would be great. Money would be super. But money is not necessarily the solution to the problem. Schools need very simple things to succeed. Schools aren't anything more than a group of grown-ups trying to do right by kids. And that's really it. And that's nothing that a whole bunch of money will solve. Of course, teachers need to be paid more, and administrators need to be paid more, and kids need supplies. But we did this on a budget of nothing, mostly by just asking people to help. Please help. Can you donate 5 gallons of paint? Can you come in and help with electricity? We asked painters to just adopt one classroom, and we would be there at, you know, from 3 in the afternoon to 2 in the morning with donuts and cheerleading, and slowly by baby steps we knocked out this whole school. 4 years into it, we really started fundraising in earnest. With this new wave of parents, some very, very clever bears came in. And one of our bears, Ted Ganchev, a dad, didn't have any experience in fundraising, but he thought, you know, maybe we really need to figure it out. Because as the school became more successful, as the neighborhood came in, we subsequently wound up losing almost every ounce of funding we have. Our school, you know, became too high, and the neighborhood became too white, and the school had too much money, and we were also not a really crazy new educational experiment, and we weren't a charter, we weren't any of the things that attracts money. So subsequently, our school makes do with a quarter of the budget of a similarly sized school in other parts of the city, which means that our art teacher doesn't have any money for supplies and things like that. So Ted learned the fundraising game, and it is a game, and there are winners and there are losers. And what we learned how to do was how to make very successful, mutually beneficial partnerships with different entities. And since it seems as though the trend is for schools to have to self-finance, and that's the way it's going, it's going to take more than a bake sale to get schools out of the predicament they're in. So if schools want more money to run things, they're going to have to learn how the fundraising game is played and start playing it the way that private schools play that game. And even though no one would talk to Ted, Ted had to figure this all out on his own, I've really tried to lay out in the last chapter of the book how he did that. The thing that's sort of unfortunate is that extra layer of cash really does in many ways separate the schools that have more social capital than other schools. So the fundraising chasm, the funding crisis in this country is really unfortunate because it pulls the disparity even wider. So I'm not saying that's a terrific thing. I think that's tragic. But if that's the state of affairs, then schools need to learn how to play this game to help save themselves. But in terms of the funding of the school, I think it's just important to reiterate that money did not power the Nettlehurst Revolution. People powered the Nettlehurst Revolution. So in retrospect, someone might look now. Last year, we just signed a $210,000 partnership with the Chicago Blackhawks, and they built this new amazing fitness room with Wii and all this crazy great stuff. And somebody might look at that now and say, oh, well, that's what happens when you get a bunch of money. That's not what happened. It was really built on the sweat equity of mommies, and we had a motto that we do more during nap time than most people do all day. And it really was built that way. So the last thing is this model, is this blueprint replicable? We get two criticisms. The first says that good schools are the inevitable byproduct of gentrification. The basic idea is sort of like you get enough sort of rich white people in a room, you're bound to have a successful school. So here are these people, they're patting themselves on the back for like having a successful school. Well, duh, of course they're going to have a successful school. They're sitting in Boys Town in East Lakeview. Why? Of course the school's going to be successful. Well, first of all, that's not true for a variety of reasons. Empirically, you look at this country and you look in stabled middle-class neighborhoods and there may be a successful school in one place, and four blocks over, the school is a disaster on stilts. Same housing stock, same everything. It is not inevitable by any stretch of the imagination. It's a question of whether the neighborhood buys in or not, whether a school will be successful. So why is it that some schools work and some schools don't when they have the same resources, same everything, just a stone's throw away from each other? The other thing I think that's important is that we did not displace anybody. All of the kids who were bused in from overcrowded schools chose to stay at Nettlehurst and could stay through eighth grade. Our school's pre-school through eight. So every single one of those kids stayed. When the third graders, the kids who went through the tuition-based preschool from the neighborhood with this new influx were tested in third grade, which is the first time kids are tested, their test scores were the highest in the city. They tested at 100% for math and 91% for reading. You have to go out, like way out to like the ritziest suburbs in Chicago for those kind of scores. Within that same time frame, though, everybody else's scores improved as well. So much so that for the past 2 years, the 7th and 8th grade classes, the 8th grade classes, of which everybody is still from an overcrowded school. Every single one of those kids that is 98% on free and reduced lunch, every single one of those kids scored high enough to go to a selective magnet school, anyone they wanted to go to in the city. Their scores are now in the 75% range. I think given the demographics and the challenges, the myriad challenges that most of those kids face at home, I think those kind of scores are really commendable. And Nettlehurst has been very successful closing the achievement gap. So a rising tide really does raise all boats in many, many ways. I don't think it was chance, although chance certainly played a part, but I don't think it happened. I don't think that our success happened on the backs of anybody, on the backs of anybody else. The second criticism I get, and I was just in D.C., and this super respected education reform person, and a woman, no less, said, sounds like your school is great, and I'm sure you mommies really are great, and that's great, 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 great. But until this project is brought to scale, your model really doesn't have a place in the reform debate, the education reform debate. And it was in front of a lot of other people, this woman said this. And all I could stammer out was, I thought mommies had already gone to scale. You know, I thought we'd scaled that problem. And there is this thought among education experts, I think, that mommies can't do this, that this isn't something that normal people can do, and certainly not mommies. And I, for the life of me, I cannot understand that kind of thinking. I mean, all I could say was, have you been to a sandbox lately? Do you have any idea the caliber of mom that is sitting around a sandbox these days? And if you want to keep a creative class in your city, if you want to keep families in your cities, then you need neighborhood schools to be successful. The neighborhood school model succeeded in this country for 100 years. Every single urban area, with the possible exception of LA, because I have no idea how LA works yet, but everybody else, every other city is based on the neighborhood school model. So the idea that that model is inherently flawed, I find it kind of hard to wrap my mind around that. And if all it took to revive that model with a little bit of mom, you know, with some mommies with some elbow grease and some simple tools at their disposal, I think it's wholly possible that this is replicable in various ways. At that same meeting in D.C., there were all these policy experts there, and David Axelrod and all these amazing people, and they were all talked 3 hours, you know, wah, 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 wah. Change takes decades. Wah, 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 wah. Change is incremental. Wah, wah. And all, you know, if everybody weren't so self-important, I would have stood up and screamed, like, we don't have time for that. We don't have decades for our schools to turn around. Change is not incremental. We've proved that change can take place overnight, truly overnight. You ask a mom with a 4-year-old, do you have 4 years to turn this school around? And she will look at you and say, I don't have 4 minutes for this school to turn around. It needs to work right now. Otherwise, my friends and I are going to pack it up and go somewhere else. Last night, I met with this amazing group of moms who's fixing Andrew Jackson School. Some of them are here. And their story is so frighteningly similar to ours, it just gave me goosebumps. Like, it's just incredible. Now, we never talked to the Jackson moms. We've talked to other moms in Chicago, but not these. So how is it possible that change is happening all over the country, just like this, independently? Well, it's happening because it's a good idea. It's not crazy. It's not bananas. It's logical. It makes sense. And I am banking on some kind of triumph of common sense. We don't need to wait for some top-down initiative to fall from the sky. I don't have problems with charter schools. I don't have problems with Uber special initiatives and people trying to do different things. All of that super stuff. But every time a selective school opens its doors, and by that selective I mean test-in or lottery, it blows out the neighborhood in the way that Home Depot blows out a neighborhood. And I like shopping at Home Depot too, right? But there's a reason why Home Depot blows out a neighborhood. Because people, well, not Home Depot, but when a selective school opens its doors, what it means is the moms, the parents who live right next to the school inevitably can't get in. And then everybody's going across town, two or three different buses and cars, and all of that energy gets dissipated, which is, kind of unfortunate. The education debate just started in Congress. In September, I met with all the Democratic senators on the Education Committee, and I really thought the debate was going to come after climate change, but I guess healthcare was such a, disastrous fight that they've decided to bring in education first, which makes sense, because it's like puppies. Who doesn't like puppies? I think it's safe. But it's going to happen, and it's happening right now, and all of the pistols went off to say that this debate is starting. So here's my dream of dreams. My dream of dreams is that this idea, this very simple, old school, nonpartisan, proven idea gets inserted into the national consciousness. And if that happens right now, when Obama says, what can you do to fix your country, right? People say, oh, well, I could buy a Pyrus, I could plant a victory garden, I can recycle, I could work in a soup kitchen, I could maybe do all this stuff. On that tippity top of their list, I hope people say, why, I could fix my neighborhood school. And right now, everybody thinks that education is so messed up that there isn't anything they possibly could do to fix it. And that's not true. There's a ton of stuff people could do to fix it. It's just that nobody knows. Nobody knows what to do. So if people knew, if people knew that they could fix their neighborhood school, that option was available to them, then I think people would do it. And if somehow this book could inspire people to gather up eight of their friends and walk into a principal's office and instead of shouting and pointing fingers and blaming people and getting huffy, although that anger is understandable, instead of doing that, if this book somehow inspired people to walk into a principal's office and say, hi, we are here to help. We are here to figure out what your dreams are, and hopefully there are dreams, and we're here to help you knock this out of the park. If the Jackson Park mom's experience could be replicated 100 times over in Philadelphia and Boston and Chicago and San Francisco, if all of those cities could tap into the mommy power that is sitting around parks, I really think that would be real systemic change. And let's pretend that educational experts who are like, oh, mommies, you guys are so dumb. Let's pretend she's right. Let's pretend we didn't fix 70% of the schools in America. Let's say mommies just fixed 20% of the schools in America. That would be real systemic change. That would be extraordinary. And that would be something to hang your hat on. So that's my real hope. So if there's any way, I don't have I don't have a marketing budget, it's just me and my little iPod. So if there's some way you can throw this idea out into the national consciousness, into cyberspace, into the world, I would be really grateful because I think we have a unique moment in history. People are talking about educational reform now in a really serious way, in a way that hasn't happened in a long, 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 long time. And we have the chance to do something amazing. And if we could do that, that would be really swell. So if you want to do just one thing to fix education, just one, after tonight, if you could throw it out into cyberspace, that'd be swell. If you want to buy a book or buy five books and put them in the hands of people who care about education, give it to a mom in a park, give it to your kids who have kids, give it to people who care. And I feel like this idea will take hold, not because it's my idea, but because it's an idea that makes intuitive sense, and I'm really banking on a triumph of common sense. So I thought we'd watch this very short video of the school, and then Dr. Ackerman hopefully will say a few words, which would be very nice. As you watch this video, oh, and we'll have some question and answer. As you watch this video, know that the pictures you see that are this big are really floor-to-ceiling murals, and every little drop of color that you see has been donated. Every little drop of it. We told artists they could paint anything they want. It just, you know, it can't be scary. It can't be phallic. Don't paint the face of Jesus. Other than that, do whatever you want. So hopefully you like that, too. So can you cue that thing? And I'll try to narrate as we go so that you can... I'll tell you what you're looking at. I'm so glad I'm not responsible for this working. Am I blocking you? Oops. Every time I do this, there's a glitch of some sort. But there's volume too.
Early in the morning before you get up.
So that's our school.
You know, she cooks them up, then she puts them in a pan.
That's my daughter, Maya. If you're wondering why a lot of the kids look sort of pasty and white like me, it's because they're my children.
Early in the morning before you get up, daddy kisses your cheeks to get you up, says brush your hair before you sit in the breakfast chair.
These are our front doors. I think you can turn
these about all your cares before you get up.
So this is the front door. These are the dots.
Early in the morning just when you get up.
These are the dots that are, there's Susan Curlin, our principal, with the Rockettes. This is our farmer's market.
Sure looks funny to me before
every
you get
Saturday.
Up. But you say,
those are my kids
oh my
with their lemonade
gosh,
stand
it's
at
a great
the market.
Big sun, it's a great big sun.
The
and you
bookstore
say,
does a free
oh
reading
gosh,
hour that's every Tuesday.
Sun.
And here's Jeff Garland who came in
and
one day to
say,
read.
Oh
here's
gosh,
our little
it's a great
bunny
big
egg
sun,
hunt.
It's a great big sun. And you
Terry
Karpowitz oh
built
my
this amazing
gosh,
sculpture
it's a great
for
big
us.
Sun.
It's a solar needle and it teaches kids about astronomy and stuff like that.
Early in the morning, you munch, munch, munch. When you run to the
there's
bus,
Susan.
Don't forget your lunch. Say, how do you do?
There's Susan with Arnie
I'm happy
Duncan,
and
who's
so
been with
are
us,
you.
You know, from the beginning.
I love you, love you, love you, love you, I do.
Diversity. It's 40% white.
Early in the morning, when you go
black,
to school, you mind
Hispanic,
your manners. Don't forget
Asian,
the rules. You raise
other.
Your hand.
And 45%
and you play in the sand. Say, yes, I, yes, I,
these
yes,
are,
yes, I
doors.
Can. And you say, oh my gosh, it's a great big sun, it's a great big sun. And you
doors.
Say, oh my gosh, it's a great big sun. And
another
you say, oh my gosh, it's a great big sun, it's a great big
this
sun. And you say, oh my gosh,
parts.
It's a great
I'm
big sun.
There's my
there
thumbs
are many open doors.
With our first fundraiser, we built new play equipment, but we also just painted the bricks, and we decorated the telephone poles. So that's just, you know, a brick wall can become a sky. These are the back auditorium doors and the other side doors. We do a lot of recycled art. So this is part of Art 44, but it's a city school, so like all the windows are graded on the bottom. There's my son at Chess Wizards, which is one of our after-school programs. Our after-school program services 250 kids a day. This is the James Play Swing.
I love you. There are many kinds of days.
We're now a site for the Chicago Marathon, so all the elite runners come. But as I said before, I live in Boys Town, so my neighborhood is always extra festive and fabulous, which is why I like it.
You
can understand.
We just signed this partnership with the Blackhawks, and they just built a fitness room for us, and we started a hockey league.
But one thing I
But we also built a dance room in my performing arts school, so we built a dance room so the kids have a place to, you know, dance. This is our World Music Cafe for upper grade students. We also have some amazing WPA murals that were in the school before we got there. They're all really marvelous. This is courses throughout literature.
No matter,
and this is a hugest WPA mural that have all been restored. But across from the mural, we made a seating area so that people would have a place to sit down. We hung loads in the stairwell. This is on the way to lunch. We made it into Atlantis. So now the littlest kids all swim to lunch, which is really cute. This is our banking center. All of the kids have their own account. All the other things kids should learn about. This is our lunchroom. We turned it into a Bistro Louis. We have a salad bar. We're actually one of the only schools in Chicago, if you can believe this, with recess. It's a gift from our teachers. They gave up a union planning period so that they could supervise recess.
Hold it in
your This is the first floor of Jenkins Place, which is our community school component. It goes earth, sky, space, so this is the earth floor. And this is the third floor, which is space.
And we'll go flying. Can you see what shines?
But the teachers just layer artwork on top
when
of
it's
it.
Dark outside.
Here we're putting together our African
I can see the moon shine. I look in your eyes.
They're all these museum quality artifacts, which are really totally amazing that a gallery gave us before they shuttered. This is our India wing. Keep in mind these are all floor-to-ceiling murals. But it's for special interest, so we wanted to make everything really tactile. So that they can This is going up the stairs to our Latin American wing, the National Museum of Mexican Fine Arts.
But only illusions.
Amazing Latin American
bows have nothing to hide. And what's so amazing that it keeps us stargazing? And what do they think we might see? Someday we'll find
this is our,
the rainbow connection,
first and second
the lovers.
So
the dreamers and
the window displays went down. We just slurped up whatever they had.
Have you been half asleep?
Here's Rahm Emanuel.
And have you
heard
the voices?
And his very first act
I've
of
heard them calling my name.
Here's the sky floor.
Is this the sweet sound that calls
so
the young sailors? The voice might be one in the same.
This is our fence project that I do with the kids for lessons.
Many times
they tie their intentions onto the fence. This year we made it a little more explicit that we were the first school to walk in Chicago's Gay Pride Parade.
We
are now on every hate blog.
Rainbow connection.
We even had the lunatic felt
the lovers,
the dreamers,
and me.
But those 3 weeks go down as probably something interesting, most interesting 3 weeks of my
Someday we'll find it. The rainbow connection. The lover. The dreamers and me.
So that's my little world. Okay. So I think when I take questions for a little bit, and then if Dr. Ackerman would say a few words, that would be great. So what questions can I ask?
I am troubled, I think, by what you said your first criticism was, which is that there are probably a lot of parents who are single parents and who may hold down two jobs and can't sit in the parks and be mommies to, like, get a lot done during nap time. I mean,
right.
There is a presumption there that there are not people who aren't struggling to keep it together.
Absolutely.
Sure.
A couple things. First of all, we were not all stay-at-home Scandinavian toy latte moms. We were half-working moms, half-stay-at-home moms. But yes, you are absolutely right that we had a tremendous amount of social capital that is not shared by all moms in all communities. And luck certainly played a huge part. And I don't want to undervalue the luck that we had. And I also don't want to undervalue the thought that we were extraordinarily entitled in the sense that we believed that school was supposed to work for us. We believed that it was our right to have a public school that was exceptional. And we weren't willing to take no from an answer from anybody who said that that couldn't happen. And you are quite right that when people are struggling to hold down two or three or five jobs, that the idea that they're going to sit around and paint murals all day is, you know, kind of silly. What I would say is a couple things. First of all, let me try to channel Susan Kurland, our principal. What Susan would say is engagement is engagement, and it doesn't really matter what people are bringing. Yes, we came up with that, but that doesn't mean that it can't happen in any community, because once people start to become engaged in any way, it's very hard to become unengaged. So it's the activity of being involved, regardless of what it actually brings. So do I think that it might take longer in other communities? Yes. Might the road be harder? Yes. But I do feel that all communities can succeed because everybody ultimately wants what's best for their own kids. We pioneered a fee-for-service community school model, but the traditional community school model was intended specifically for underserved, impoverished neighborhoods. And that comes, I mean, obviously, you know, you're not going to ask kids to pay for a $10 ballet class if people don't have $10 and they don't have, you know, services like that in their neighborhood. But the community school model was intended for that and comes in with funding for that. But the energy that it brings is the same, which is how do you bring a community together? How do you make a school a heart of the community? And I think that that truly crosses class and race and race issues, and I don't think I'm being Pollyanna about it, because I think that everybody wants what's best for their kid.
And that's what I really loved about, you know, the whole energy behind it. How do you engage? Because I have friends who are school teachers in the public school system. How do you engage parents who are just trying to
get
it together?
Ours was somewhat different in that, first of all, we had a bust-in community. So the environment that we walked into was different. You know, we had a toxic teaching staff. We had a toxic local school council that was mired in lawsuits and craziness. So we walked into our unique environment. We did not try to engage the families at the school, which is, you know, interesting, and that gets us some flack. We didn't, because our climate was really toxic, and most of the families that were there, because the students were bussed in, were absent for a variety of understandable reasons. What we did was we activated a community that surrounded a school. Most schools are looking down at the grindstone, and principals and teachers are looking down at a grindstone. Most people haven't been in a school like since they graduated eighth grade and have no idea how hard it is to be a school principal or how hard it is to be a teacher. They're not just teaching anymore. The amount of junk and crap they have to go through every single day to get through a day is insane. I mean, insane. So the idea that they're going to go out and paint a mural on the sidewalk or call stores and see if they can come pick up their window displays or work on a marketing campaign or do a grant. It's crazy. They can't do that. So part of it is asking principals and communities to look up outside of the school to say, what's in your neighborhood? What partnerships can we create? How can we wrap our arms around this beyond the model of engagement that just says, how can we make Johnny's mom be more interested in Johnny's thing and come to a potluck dinner? It's a wholesale different way of saying, how can we make a school a heart of a community? Not that that isn't valuable, too. It is, too. But the kind of radical transformation that we're talking about is bringing an entire community together. Does that answer? Other questions? Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned the parents who were there. Whether or not there was an active parents organization when you went in, and if you engaged with them, or the local school council, how you dealt with whatever was...
The answer is there was nothing in place. There was not a PTA. There was not an anything. We called ourselves the Nettlehurst Parents Co-op because we thought it sounded kind of snotty and elitist, and we thought it would be a way to drag in the neighborhood. But that was the climate that we walked into. The only parents who were there and involved were extraordinarily toxic. We would have done anything under the sun to, you know, appease these people. All they wanted to do was have Susan fired, and there were massive lawsuits flying, and the local school council was crazy. So much so that I only went to one local school council meeting, and I stood up and started screaming. You know, that there just wasn't time for this nonsense, and I wasn't allowed. My group didn't let me go back to the local school. I wasn't the representative anymore who went to those things. So our tactic was to fly very low to the radar. Obviously, different schools will have to, you know, address their own needs. Most reform movements around the country derail for two reasons. The first reason is people walk in from the neighborhood to a principal and say, "Hi, we're here to help." And the principal says, "You know, if you don't like what you see here, there are four different schools that are probably better suited to people like you. We're not interested," right? And they alienate the principal from the get-go. And so nothing happens, or actually there are three. Or the principal says, "Great, nice to meet you," and kind of gives them the runaround and gives them on the back burner, and then they get started for a few months and then realize that they're basically twiddling their thumbs and wasting their time. Or the group of incoming parents is insensitive to the socioeconomic or racial demographics of the environment that they're walking into, and either out of, you know, hubris or naivete or whatever, bungles it and creates a great big bonfire and then isn't asked to leave but, like, starts to run because they've made a mess of things. So those are the three. And that happens if you follow chat boards, and we have because we're freaks. It's all over the place. Those are why those unrail. So, you know, you have to be strategic and you have to be sensitive to what's going on. Other questions? Yeah.
During the presentation, you mentioned that the curriculum team had determined that academically the school was not broken, fundamentally wasn't broken. Yet you refer to the toxic teaching environment and a lot of toxicity in the school. What did you use to assess that it wasn't? What criteria did you use to assess that it wasn't, or that it was fundamentally
sound? Okay. First of all, again, I'm not a teacher. I know happy when I see it and sad when I see it, and that's about where I top out. Here was, like, big news to us. Actually, the state of Illinois has it pretty well locked up. Who knew? They actually have a curriculum. All schools are held to the same standards. They all take the same tests. They all basically use the same curriculum. It's all basically the same stuff, but people on the outside don't know that so much because people think that there are only four or five golden schools and that they've been given some kind of golden magic box, and only the really good schools get that box, and everybody else is making, you know, do with Chiclets, right? Which isn't true. But it kind of takes people who are smart, who can figure that out, to say, no, actually, you're using the same math curriculum, you're using the same everything. What we did find out is that parents can put a spin on things and their own twist on things that you can radically change the flavor and the way schools feel and the way the strength and the emphasis of the school, so long as your principal is on board. If your principal is not on board, nothing can happen. And I mean nothing at all. Parents are one part, but parents can't do it without principals. Susan was a good educator, a great educator, and she was a good administrator. So Susan, I think, I honestly believe one of Susan's greatest gifts was that she said yes over and over and over again. Yes, you want to put a bathtub in the library? Okay. You want to put a boat downstairs in the basement? All right. I mean, I just met a superintendent last night. What is his name again? Dr. Burnley. I met this guy who could have been Susan Kurland, you know, reincarnated in a man. I mean, there he was. Here was a man saying, great, you want to bring in language? Let's figure out how to do that. You know, you're not asking for something that's crazy. She did shoot down ideas that she thought were terrible. Like, we wanted a surveillance system in the preschools. Like, I think it's called Zazzle or something like that. She was like, yeah, no. At a certain point, you're going to have to trust us that we're doing our job, and you're not going to look through some portal all day. And she emphatically rejected a gifted program. Like, absolutely not. All kids are capable of learning, really believed in differentiated instruction. So there were some things that they wanted that she said no about. There were some things we wanted that she moved on. But it was really us working with her. But no, it's not a disaster. I think most people would be really shocked by how much really great teaching is going on in public schools. I mean, I've sat in personally on every single hiring decision that's been made at this school in 6 years. The caliber of teacher that walks in is mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. We have teachers with master's degrees from Harvard and MIT and 7 Door Smiths. I mean, it's insane. I don't think anybody knows about it. And part of it is that, you know, public schools can't really articulate what's going on. Are we running short on time? So let's have one more question, and then we'll have Dr. Ackerman talk. Is that okay? Okay. Oh, right.
A question I actually have for the audience is a little self-serving. Does anybody live in the 1913 Osage
County?
All right.
Woohoo!
Well, I heard of the wearing and I'm scared.
Okay.
All right. So you found your tribe. Great. Okay. So, Dr. Ackerman, would you? Yes.
Oh, okay.
Please come say some words.
Oh, that's okay. I'd rather stand right here because I didn't come to steal your thunder. I just came to listen after another meeting. I just want to thank you all for coming out. Thank Jacqueline for sharing. I have the book. I haven't read it, but I plan to. And just listening to you, I looked at that school and I'm like, who wouldn't want their child in that school? It's too bad all of our schools can't look like that. I mean, because half of what you need is an environment that's conducive to learning. So, on behalf of those of us who've been listening, it was inspiring to listen to the part that I've been able to listen to and to see, you know, actually the school. It was beautiful. It really was. And to the parents, I guess the Jackson parents, who sort of started this and were inspired by this, thank you, because you can make a difference. One of my core beliefs is that parents are our partners. I really, really believe that. And not all of the parents can contribute in the same way. But I think that you're absolutely right. In my 41 years in education, I've never met a parent who didn't want for his or her child what I wanted for mine. Never. I may not understand their lifestyle, the decisions that they make, but when you sit them down and you talk to them, they will tell you, I want something better for my child. So I think we have to go with where parents are. And not all of them come in the same package. But I was thinking, if you couldn't do it during the week, maybe you could do this kind of thing on the weekend when they're off. But we need to take the school to where the parents are. And I believe that these kinds of activities can happen even in some of the neighborhoods where we believe they can. I've been here almost 2 years. And I've now talked to more than 4,000 parents.
Wow.
I have a monthly meeting. They come out 300 or 400 at a time. And they just want to be invited in. Sometimes they don't know how to be invited in, but you're right. It makes a difference. If I hear anything from most of my parents, it's about the fact that they don't feel they're really welcome. And so I think the school district has to do a better job of reaching out to parents and embracing them. I use the word not involved, but embracing, because when you think of embracing, it's like you're putting your arms around parents. So I'm hopeful that we can get this book and put it in our parent resource centers. I know we will,
good.
Because I think it's something that parents, all parents, need to read. And I'm inspired. I'm inspired by the fact that the Jackson parents got together and put this on, and for the other parents who are about to get together and start their own little revolution, come in. We can do this job without parents, but it is so much easier to do it with parents. You know, I tell my staff all the time, you want them there. Your job will be 10 times easier if they're there, engaged, and involved in this process of educating our children. So I thank you for coming to Philadelphia and sharing your story. There's a lot that I think we can learn from reading your book and following your guidance and how to get parents engaged and parents from all walks of life. I just believe if you build something, your parents will come. But it's got to be parent-friendly. And often I don't think we in schools think about the fact who our parents are. We do things and I don't quite understand them. You know, I really don't, and I've been an educator for a long time. But if 90% of our parents were, why do we have our parent-teacher conferences in the middle of the day? It means that we have to think about, when I was a principal, we had actually had the superintendent gave us permission to have our parent-teacher conferences in the evening and on the weekend. And then, you know what? We had 99% of our parents show up. And those that didn't, we went to their homes. So I think it is about finding a way to embrace parents who come with great ideas, who want to be involved. And there's no bigger magnet, as far as I'm concerned, to getting parents involved than other parents. So you want your parents involved. We want you involved. We want you there even before we have your children there. We want you there. It's your school. You own it. It's a public school. So you know that you have my support. And I just hope that this kind of movement will spring up all around the school district. And I hope we can get it in places people think that we can't get this kind of movement, but it can happen. So I thank you, Jacqueline. I didn't mean to...
No, I'm so glad you're here.
So I wouldn't have to stand up there and talk, but I'm really impressed with what I heard. And I thank you for coming to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
Sharing your story.
Thank you for coming, really.
Dr. Ackerman, and thank Jacqueline Elberg for coming to the library and speaking to us tonight.
She's
going to be signing her book upstairs in the lobby. So thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming, everybody. Thanks. Good night. Come.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.